Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey, and this is High Performance, the podcast that shows you it's within. Your ambitions, your dreams, your purpose, it's all there. We just unlock it by taking the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers and turning them into your life lessons. So right now, allow myself and Professor Damien Hughes to speak to one of the most impressive rugby players in the world.
My skill set is pretty much based on output. It's based on how hard I can work and the effectiveness of those collisions or of those involvements in a game and the accumulated amount of those across an 80-minute window. If I was going to succeed in this, it had to come from me. It wasn't me relying on anyone else. You know, it was me having to wake up to catch the train, to catch the bus, to get to training. It just gave me that self-motivation. The way they viewed me was never based on how good or bad I was at rugby. So it wasn't necessarily a part of my self-worth, whether I was good at rugby or whether I was bad at rugby. So in a way, it gives a certain sense of freedom as well, because I think when you wholly define your life through what you do, if that is then taken away from you, it becomes difficult.
So today we welcome Maro Itoje to the High Performance Podcast, someone who epitomizes an elite mindset in rugby. In fact, stay where you are, because as soon as this episode begins, he gives us an amazing definition of high performance. You know that first question we always ask? What does high performance mean to you? I know we've pretty much had a different answer from every guest, but we've certainly not even had an answer that comes close to the kind of approach that Maro takes. And then he talks about his discipline as a young lad growing up. And I think where he's really humble is he doesn't say that he's a flair player. He's not a Lionel Messi. He doesn't see himself as a superstar rugby player that uses his natural ability to change the game. He sees himself as a grafter, a really hard worker. And I think what's really special there is that we should all have that view of ourselves. As soon as we think that we're special, or as soon as we think that our natural talent or that our intuition or that our emotional intelligence will see us past a problem, then I think we stop working. And I think we may well still have all those things which will help. And there's no doubt that Maro is not doing himself justice, and he is an incredibly talented natural athlete. But the fact that he thinks that his secret sauce is hard work is really powerful. So let's get to it then. A really fascinating conversation with an amazing rugby player as we welcome England and Saracens forward Maro Itoje to the High Performance Podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to High Performance.
Thank you.
What is your definition of high performance?
So, you know, I listen to your guys' podcasts. I've been listening for a number of years, and obviously this is the first question that you guys always open up with. So in preparation for this, I was thinking, what would my definition of high performance be? And I don't have a too fancy definition, to be honest, but I do think there's a distinction between high performance and elite performance. I think high performance is relative. I think it's perhaps subjective to each individual. You know, what's high performance for you will be different to what's high performance for me, and so on and so forth. However, I think elite performance is performing at the very top level in your given field. Whatever field that may be.
See, I think that's a really interesting definition. And by the way, this is maybe episode 170, whatever. Mm. You're the first person that has created that differentiation between high performance and elite performance. And I'm pleased you have, because often I think people are put off almost by the title of our podcast because they assume high performance is for someone else, not for them. And we try and drill home the message that it's your version of high performance, exactly as you say. Yet elite performance, it's about comparing yourself to others. It's about being in the company of others. It's about where you sit in that list of top performers. So how do you ensure that you're an elite performer, not a high performer?
I guess there's several aspects to that. I think the first is being honest with yourself. After you play, you know, I'm a rugby player, so I'll use rugby references. And after you've played at a number of years at a certain level, you kind of get a gauge of your body, you get a gauge of, you know, how you're performing. And I like to think, other people may disagree, but I like to think that I have a relatively good gauge of how I'm performing, how well I'm performing, and, you know, when I'm off that, what that, how that looks like, how it feels. So in order to almost hopefully stay at an elite level, I think requires a sincere amount of honesty. Honesty, and, you know, you need to have a look at yourself and be like, okay, where am I? Where do I want to get to? How do I need to improve? I guess what's underpinning all of that is a general sense of always looking to improve, always looking to keep the ball moving. I think if you stay idle for too long or rest on your laurels in any given respect, then that is probably the time where you start to go downhill.
See, what you're describing there is the classic case of the Dunning-Kruger law, aren't you? But so the Dunning-Kruger law was named after two guys, David Dunning and Justin Kruger, that said that if you're good at something, you have the self-awareness to know why you're good at it. Equally, if you're not good at something, you lack self-awareness to know what are the areas you need to improve in. So I'm interested in how you've learned to do that kind of self-analysis and to raise your levels of self-awareness to constantly keep improving or picking up little areas that you can get better at.
Yeah, I'm by no means an expert of this. I don't want to sound as if, you know, I've cracked the code. But I think part of that is innate. I think a part of it is, I think, just how my psychological makeup is. I think I'm quite receptive to people questioning me or criticizing me in certain respects, especially when it's performance related. The other aspect of it is also the nature of perhaps the environments that I was raised in. When I say raised, I'm talking about from a sporting point of view. You know, I grew up in, I've been at Saracen since the age of 14. That's where I, you know, kind of had my formative years with regards to performance. And, you know, the environment there is very much at getting better. It's very much about people telling you when you're wrong, praising you when you're right. They're very good at that as well. But it's very much about trying to get better, trying to exceed in, you know, and achieve that common goal. So I guess it's a mixture of nature and nurture.
Can we touch a bit more on the nurture? I'd love to know what was in the upbringing at home that not only led you towards playing rugby, which was a sport that you hadn't played before you finally got the opportunity, but then your dogged determination to make a success out of it. And I know that you hold your Nigerian values and roots very close. And I wonder, to what extent do you carry that with you in your career and how that's helped you?
Well, I think there's several aspects to that question. I think the first part, which I'll touch on, is I'm very, very proud of like my Nigerian heritage. It's a essential part of who I am. It's formed the lens in which I see the world. It's shaped me. I can't even describe how much it shapes me.
Can you expand on what and why?
Yeah, I grew up in North London. I've never lived in Nigeria. I've been to Nigeria several times on holiday and vacation, but I've never lived there. And why has it shaped me in such a way? My parents were born in Nigeria, both of them. They both spent some of their schooling abroad, etc., but they were firmly like brought up and bred in Nigeria. And I always describe my house or my parents' house as it was like living in Lagos, but in London, because the house was very Nigerian in terms of culture, in terms of values, in terms of, you know, the food we ate, in terms of the people coming in and out of the house. But I step outside the house, then I'm in North London. You know, being Nigerian or being raised in the way in which I was raised has just formed my viewpoint on the world. It's you know, the first reference I had to anything else, and everything else has been affected by that. I guess in terms of what that actually looks like, I guess Nigerians, they hold respect in high regard. My parents never tolerated any form of disrespect. Like, even to this day, there's certain things that, you know, I wouldn't say in and around my parents because they hold respect to such a
high. Bad language and things like that.
So I try not to use profanity for different reasons, for religious reasons.
Right.
But if I was to use it in front of them, it would feel weird. Right. It would just feel like odd. So I'll give you an example. So in Western culture, in British culture, you know, is not unusual to call, I guess, your auntie by her first name, by Jane or whatever. Whereas if I called my auntie like by her first name, I have an auntie Stella. If I called her Stella, it's like I'm insulting her. It's a massive lack of respect I'm showing her, because it's just like the hierarchical nature of like Nigerian families. But even besides respect, there's, you know, in terms of family values, in terms of hard work, in terms of community, there's so many aspects to it.
How much of that, you've described Saracens as your home, did you see a values match there from what you're describing?
So I remember the first time I went into Saracens, well, the senior environment, and I was 16 years old or so, and they called me up to take part in, you know, the first team training. I was nervous but incredibly excited, and you know, all these players that I've seen on TV, I was now going to be in the change room with them and train with them. So I was, you know, super excited but at the same time incredibly anxious and nervous. And I walked into the little corridor, and the first person I saw was a scrum half called Neil de Kock. And he was like, "Hello, Mara, how are you doing?" Shook my hand straight away. And I was like, wow, this is one of the most experienced players on the team, and he's embracing me so warmly. And it, you know, really took me aback. Then we had players there like John Smith, who was Springboks captain, World Cup winner, etc., doing the exact same. So I was interacting with all these players, and they were, you know, treating me with so much respect, and they were so kind to me. Someone that they don't know, you know, just some young kid from the academy. And, you know, as you know, there's so many young kids in the academy that it's hard to, you know, always show these guys the respect, or is, you know, just be consistent with it anyway. But they were all embracing me so warmly. For me, it was like the perfect place to grow. It was a perfect place for me to try and learn and like expand my skills in that respect.
And can you share with our listeners what the respect and the values and the discipline that you've just talked about does for you as an athlete, because I think that we still sometimes have a dissonance here where it's like, I'm going to be really respectful. Oh, but that's got nothing to do with performing at an elite level. And then we see other people performing at an elite level who we know are not disciplined and are not respectful. And we kind of assume that you don't need them both. But I get the sense that the discipline element is a really important one for the performance element for you.
Yeah. I'm not one of those players who I guess is... I don't know if any of you see me play rugby, but I'm not necessarily the most skillful player on the field. You know, I'm not one of those players who can kick the ball 70 yards or, you know, spin off my left, off my right, 30 meter passes. I don't perhaps have that deft touch that some players are graced with. You know, my skill set is pretty much based on output. Is based on how hard I can work and the effectiveness of those collisions or of those involvements in a game and the accumulated amount of those across an 80-minute window. And as you kind of alluded to before, rugby is not a sport that I grew up in. It's not a sport that I, when I was 1 to 11, dreamed of playing. I barely knew what rugby was at that point. So, you know, I wasn't brought up in the tradition of rugby. So it really didn't come naturally to me. I guess what discipline gave me was the fact that, you know, I needed to be consistent with it. I needed to work hard with it. And even backtracking a little bit, my upbringing was very disciplined in terms of, you know, how we were in our family house, how my parents were with education, with studying. But they were, in terms of sport, they weren't disciplined at all. They're like, oh yeah, go exercise. But in my early years, didn't really care what that looked like or what that was. So, you know, when I first started getting into rugby, you know, rugby with Nigerians is not really a thing that they, you know, you don't really connect. So when I first started getting into rugby, it was seen as a potential distraction. I remember if my dad was here, he would always tell the story. He loves telling this story, so I'll tell it for him. But he told this story that, you know, my housemaster called him up and he was like, oh, your son's very good at rugby. Then he, you know, he was a little bit worried that rugby may be a distraction, and he called me. I was like, if the grades drop, the rugby stops. So, but anyway, the point I'm trying to make with that is the discipline that I had through other aspects of my life, I was then able to transfer that to rugby and how I trained, you know, waking up at a certain time, making sure I was eating the right things. And that was all pretty much self-driven because my parents didn't care.
See, because that's a really fascinating area. I'd just like to pause and explore deeper, because we have lots of parents that listen to this who maybe have aspirations for their children, that maybe the ones that are driving them to practice, urging them to go out and do the extras and things like that. And yet your parents were almost hands off and just gave you freedom to, if you want to do it, that's fine, as long as it doesn't affect your schoolwork. Mm. What do you think that gave you in terms of as an advantage as a young athlete?
I think for me, it just made it so that if I was going to succeed in this, it had to come from me. It wasn't me relying on anyone else. You know, it was me having to wake up to catch the train, to catch the bus, to get to training. It was me having to, you know, tell my parents that, oh, can I get some money to get some food for this, or it was me or having to organize that. And it just gave me that self motivation. And also, and this is also another interesting piece with regards to like identity. My parents, the way they viewed me was never based on how good or bad I was at rugby.
Really?
So it wasn't necessarily a part of my self-worth whether I was good at rugby or whether I was bad at rugby. So I, in a way, it gives a certain sense of freedom as well, because for me personally, it gave me the freedom and probably the encouragement to explore different aspects of my life, which made it so that rugby, to this day, probably not will never be my full identity.
I love that. I mean, there's a real echo there, as you're saying it, about we interviewed Ian Thorpe, the legendary swimmer, and he was talking about the importance of early ownership in his journey. His dad said to him, if you commit to swim, you have to do it for the season, but after that, it's up to you. But his other rule was, you have to wake me up to take you swimming. I'll never wake you up. So he put the responsibility on him to get up in the morning, set his alarm, get himself ready. And there's lots of research on this, that early ownership of an athlete actually helps them thrive over a longer term. But I think the stuff you talk about there about the identity allows you to, if you'd wanted to walk away from rugby, you were never Maro the Saracens player. You were Maro the son, the student, the guy that's got an interest in Nigerian art or any of those other things. So how would your parents describe you then? What's the kind of identity that you have at home?
I'm not too sure how they would describe me. The way I like to describe myself is like a multifaceted individual who has interests in a whole range of different things. I think about it a lot because, you know, is also linked into the other end of the scale when it comes to like retirement and stuff. I think when you wholly define your life through what you do, if that is then taken away from you, it becomes difficult. And I've always been of the opinion that the other interests I have help with what I do with rugby. I remember when I was doing my undergrad degree, I'll go into uni and, you know, meet a whole load of people who have no idea about rugby and have no interest. And I'll be studying, blah, blah, blah. But then when I go back to training, that's the fun part. That's the part that's interesting. That's the part that's fun. And it made me value the time that I had training even more.
See, again, that's an interesting area that I know you've spoke a lot, Jake, about your work in football, that it's often used as a stick to beat footballers with, that if they have interest in businesses or they're doing other studies, they're all, like when they underperform on the field, it's the first thing.
It depends what the interest, and this is what frustrates me, right? If you're a footballer and you talk about staying home playing PlayStation or whatever, then no one criticises it. We had Hector Bellerin on the podcast, the former Arsenal player, and you know, as soon as he showed an interest in fashion or an interest in photography, and we see it now with modern players who will go to, you know, the fashion show in Italy or something. Suddenly, if they don't perform on the pitch, the issue is that they're more interested in fashion. And we live in this world where we want to put people in a box. And if you're the sort of footballer that spends hours and hours playing on a computer game, then we're cool with that because for whatever reason, we think that that's all right. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you show a real passion for something other than football, we think it's detrimental to the game. I'd love to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I agree with the sentiment of what you're saying. And, you know, to a lesser extent, perhaps I think I potentially have experienced some of that. What I think, but on the flip side of that also, sometimes it's the truth. Sometimes, you know, players or people do get distracted by X, Y, or Z. So there's a balance that you need to find. And the way I've always tried to approach it is that you have to keep the main thing the main thing. Whilst I'm playing rugby, you know, rugby will always be the focus. Then everything else will have to fit around rugby. I think you have to keep your focus on the thing that is important to you. And you can't lose that focus, lose that intent. However, that being said, when I'm at club, you know, we train 3 days a week with the game on the weekend. Then those training days, most of those days, I'm finished in or around 3 o'clock. And there's only so much recovery you can do. There's only so much analysis you can do. So there's the point I'm trying to make, there's loads of time in the week if you choose to use your week wisely to pursue any interests or, you know, passions outside of your sport.
Our take on this, right, is that you're a human being that plays rugby. You're not a rugby player, right? And there's a really interesting book by Sam Harris called The Captain Class, where he basically concludes that a team is not about a star player or even about a coach. It's about the leadership in the team. It's about the captain. And there are seven traits of being an elite captain. And, you know, elite is a word that you used right at the start of this podcast. We thought it'd be interesting to explore the seven traits that he talks about in his book and just get your thoughts on them, because I think all of them will resonate.
Now, can I just say that when I interviewed Sam, when he did his book, it came out in 2016, in the conversation, he cited you as a great example of one of these leaders. He talks about the captain class. We talk about them as the cultural architects, the guys that don't necessarily have to have the title, but they set the tone for the culture. And he was really clear that he saw you as a perfect epitome of it. The pressure's on in terms of the answers.
We're either going to prove him wrong or prove him right in the next 20 minutes.
He's very kind.
And I think what we really want from this is a conversation about, obviously we know it's centered around rugby, but it's really about the mindsets that people can take into their everyday lives, you know, because effectively we're all playing a game. Yours is rugby. For other people, it's a different element, but we're all doing the same thing. So the first trait is extreme doggedness and focus when it comes to competition. I'd love to know how you develop that grit and silence the noise around you.
Again, it goes back to focus. You know, you just need to focus on what's important. If you've played at a given level at over a certain period of time, you know, you go through highs and lows, and often is never as good as it seems and is never as bad as it seems, depending on, you know, where you are on the cycle. And I think it's important to keep that perspective, because when you go through it and when you're in it, it feels like either you're the, you know, it's the worst thing that could possibly happen, or, you know, you're Superman and no one can touch you, when it's never that. So I think it's always good to keep that perspective and maintain the focus of where you want to go. And with this, what I found helpful with this especially is the people that you have around you. You know, if you have, whether it's, you know, support staff, teammates, coaches that kind of ebb and flow with the highs and lows of sport, then it's much harder. If you have people who, you know, are also of the similar mindset of want to keep the focus, want to keep pushing, and not necessarily settled with the success, but also keep perspective when you go through tough moments, then it allows you to maintain the focus and allows you to keep perspective. And, you know, I think it just allows you to keep that like doggedness when it's going well, but also when it's not going well, it probably helps you keep that doggedness as well, because you know you have to keep on going to in order to get it right.
So tell us, you know, when you describe that experience of going as a 16-year-old boy into the first team environment, or 17-year-old boy, what kind of things were you learning about doggedness and grit that maybe you hadn't had from your schoolboy rugby at that stage?
The first impression was just the physicality of it. You know, I was a 16-year-old playing with men, fully formed men. And, you know, I go and, you know, at school, as you probably could imagine, I was, you know, amongst the tallest, amongst the strongest, et cetera, et cetera. And I went into an environment where probably the nines could beat me up if they wanted to, the scrum halves. So it was very different. And being the position I am, that's the bit that you need to get pretty quickly, especially if you want to accelerate your career as quick as possible. You need to be able to be tough. You need to have that grit, have that fight within you. And at Saracens especially, spoke a lot about like effort errors. Like, you know, effort errors aren't acceptable. If you make a skill error, then, you know, that's on the coaches, or, you know, we can work on that. But what can't be in question is your intent. What can't be in question is your fight. What can't be in question is how hard you're willing to work. That's a non-negotiable. So I guess like growing up in that, you know, school of thought, and, you know, seeing players in the team who had that fight, who had that, you know, and seeing those players in the positions that I wanted to get to was like an example of, you know, where I needed to go.
But if we go to like the real granular detail of a moment when you're 16, you get put on your backside where it hurts, you're seeing guys that seem like they're on a different level physically.
There's two moments that come to mind. The first one was I was maybe about 17 or 18, And I was joining in with, again, the senior session. And they were doing this, I think it was a strongman circuit, like a strongman fitness circuit. And it was like, we're pushing a Prada up and down, like a relay type of race. So I joined one of the teams and they were pushing the Prada, pushing the Prada. It got to my turn. I'm like, I couldn't push it. And I think at the time, he's now a coach, Kenny Brown, was like, oh, we're gonna take some weight off of this little boy. They started taking the weight off. I'm like, damn, I need to improve here.
See, but you just, if I could just pause you there, Marok, because at that moment, you have a choice, don't you? You can either go, it's not for me, you know, maybe I've just sort of, like, I've reached my limit, or you've gone, I've got to improve. Where does that come from? Because this is what separates high performance from elite performance, I think.
I guess though, the level that I wanted to get to, I like to think of myself as a fairly competitive individual. I want to be one of the best players to play. I want to be at a certain level. You know, I had goals that I wanted to achieve. And, you know, I was with players who at the time, I guess back then, your goals always change. But back then, my goal was wanting to be a first team Saracens player. And, you know, that was then the standard of what first team Saracens players were doing. And I guess I wasn't living up to that standard. So I knew that in order to get to that standard, there was a gap and I needed to improve in order to reach that standard. And, you know, with the way of life, when you then eventually reach that standard, then you're looking a little bit higher of, okay, now I'm a Saracens player, I want to be a first team player. Then when you reach first team player, England player, so on and so forth.
And I interrupted you, you were going to tell me about the second occasion.
And this one was a bit in regards to, like, again, the physical differential between where I was and where I needed to be. It was my first game for Saracens. It was a preseason game. I think that I was playing at blindside flanker for the game. Anyway, we're playing the rugby team in Rotherham. And, you know, Rotherham are known for having gnarly forwards, like big, strong, physical team, mainly a set-piece sort of team. And as, you know, it happens in rugby, there was a little scuffle that was happening. And then I came in to, like, protect my players. I pushed one guy. Then he looked at me, then pushed me back. Then I was like, I just felt the push in my chest. I was like, whoa, this is the same teenagers that I'm used to pushing. These are men. Love I felt it. The weight in his arms. And then luckily, one of my teammates came to back me up. Otherwise, I would have been in a bit of trouble. So that was another example of, like, me realizing that I need to get back in the gym.
This works, though, because the second thing on the list of the traits of elite captains is aggressive play that tests the limit of the rules, which is exactly what you've described. Even as a 16-year-old coming into that environment, you were happy to do it. You're also renowned on the pitch as something of a trash talker. So I'm fascinated to just talk about this for a moment, because here we have this guy in front of us, eloquent, bright, well-educated, demonstrating control, not swearing, let alone in front of his parents, yet on the rugby field, there'll be opponents thinking, hold on a minute, I met a different Marrow when I went up against Saracens or England. So how do you marry the two characters, and what does that trash talking do for you?
You know, I think rugby is an emotional game, emotional sport, and, you know, you need to be, well, for me anyway, people are different. I need to be of a different mindset when I'm playing as opposed to when I'm just having a lovely conversation with two lovely gentlemen. So, you know, I don't need to, you know, carry that same confrontational energy when I'm here than when I'm on the field. I don't even know if I'm a trash talker like that, to be honest.
I've heard people speak really, really complimentary, except when they've been on the receiving end.
I don't even know if I'm a trash talker like that. I think I perhaps, you know, do engage in it a little bit. You know, I think what potentially frustrates, you know, opposition is that I can be quite loud. You know, I like to celebrate the little moments quite enthusiastically.
And what's that about? Is that about affecting them or affecting you and your team?
Well, it's first and foremost is like most of my actions is for me first and foremost. So I feel as if, you know, as I said, kind of touched on earlier, I'm not the player that is, I guess, blessed with so much innate skill. A lot of my attributes in rugby is about energy, is about the how many involvements I can have in the game, how many positive contributions I can have in the game. So I use those moments to try and G myself up with regards to energy and hopefully energize my teammates. And I guess the byproduct of that is it rubs people up the wrong way sometimes, but the byproduct of rubbing people up the wrong way gives me more energy. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I just want to talk to you very briefly about what I believe to be a total revolution in sleep, and it's called 8Sleep. It's a pod cover that goes on the mattress that's currently on your bed, and it controls the temperature to suit you perfectly. And it all works from this app. Me and my wife, we like different temperatures. I actually like my side of the bed cooler. But the 8Sleep isn't just about the temperature. It's your own personal sleep coach. I get a sleep fitness score. I can find out more about the quality of my sleep, the kind of routine that I'm in. But it also gives me the different sleep stages as well, so I can find out how much REM sleep or deep sleep I'm getting. And then I can tailor things in my own life, like alcohol or coffee before bed or when I work out, to try and improve my sleep. And we all know that sleep is the foundation of high performance. If we can improve our sleep, we can improve so much of our life. It's time to bring tech to the bedroom by going to 8sleep.com/HPP, where you can get £200 off your pod and free shipping. That's 8sleep.com/HPP.
Today's show is brought to you in association with MindLift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So MindLift is neuroscience based. And what I love about MindLift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out MindLift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So MindLift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
We recently interviewed Sam Tompkins from Rugby League on this, and he has a similar reputation as being one of the sport's great trash talkers. And when we spoke to him about it, his answer was, I'll do anything for that extra 1%. And one of the things we spoke about was that while he's trash talking, he's not looking to see whether his opponent's listening. He's looking for the next play, and he's just doing it. It's almost like as that little 1% to get the advantage. So I think it sounds similar. It's not criticism, this stuff that in the ball.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I definitely see mine as first and foremost, it's definitely about giving, you know, my teammates and myself energy. It's just the added bonus that it potentially runs people up the wrong way.
It's the power of these marginal gains, little things you can do, I think, that can create an edge. Let's talk about another one. Number three is a willingness to do thankless jobs in the shadows is the trait of an elite leader. We know that there's a phrase at Saracens, the shit that no one ever sees. Could you share more on that with us?
Yeah, TSPDS is all about, you know, all the little things that makes a winning team or a winning performance that the outside world doesn't necessarily pay too much attention to. But without that, you know, the star moments can't happen. And, you know, as with most things in life, you always see the highlight moments and the big landmark moments, which, you know, captures everyone's imagination. But more than likely, there's loads of little things that have happened in the background that have allowed that moment to take place. And, you know, I think as a part of our processes, we try and pay, you know, significant attention to people doing the shit that people don't see.
Like what? Can you give us an example of what that is?
It could be a kick chase. It could be getting up from the ground quickly and getting back in the line. It could be just doing an extra effort to put pressure on the 10's foot just so his kick is 5% worse than what it would have been. It could be, you know, in the line out, it could be a little shimmy away from the ball for the people who aren't involved in the actual lift, which may just distract their eyes a little bit, which gives us more space to win the ball. You know, it could be anything really. But all those little things make a big difference. One of my coaches used to told me once that nothing is ever neutral. You're either positively influencing the team or you're negatively influencing the team. You know, no action is neutral. So, you know, in that respect, you know, everything matters. Everything you do matters. Everything you do has a consequence, either positive or negative. It's either bringing you closer to the goal or taking you further away.
Which brings us to number four then on Sam's list, which is a low-key, practical and democratic communication style. The research in the book is really fascinating on this, where there's a sort of MIT studies on it about leaders, that it's not about doing big Churchillian speeches, it's the way that they communicate with like quiet gestures or eye contact or physical contact. It's like the glue of leadership.
I'll let a little secret out. I've actually read this book, and in the book they gave the example with Tim Duncan and they're talking about how he's not, you know, he's not a massively loud person. He's not an extrovert, but he's very good at connecting, very good at touching base with different people, whether it's, you know, verbal or just like little eye contact and stuff like that. And yeah, it's I guess it's important. It's important. I think everyone has a different style of how to do that. For some people, it may be a bit more extroverted. So for others, it may be a bit more introverted or in the shadows. But, you know, they both can be as effective as one another.
What's yours?
I don't think I'm necessarily the loudest person in the, you know, when in the environment. I don't think I'm one of those guys who, you know, you walk into a room, you'll hear his voice like dominating, you know, everyone else. But at the same time, on the pitch, I tend to be loud, because it goes back to that energy type of thing that I want to create for myself and for the team. So I can be quite noisy. You may hear me shouting and screaming and stuff. And so I don't know. I think I'm a mixture of both. I think I probably lean more towards connecting with people, touching base. You know, I like to think that if I do need to speak, I will speak, and if I do need to talk to the team, then I will do that if it's the right time and place. But I don't think I'll be described as, you know, the loudest person in the room.
I'd like that though. I mean, the next captain's trait in the book was motivating others with passionate non-verbal displays. And there's that old phrase, isn't there? The squeakiest wheel gets the most oil. So, you know, traditionally the loudest person gets the most attention. I like to think that we're moving into an era where it's not about how loud you are, it's about what you've got to say. Have you noticed that in rugby, that you can have an impact on a team without needing to be a loud, sweary, shouty, kind of full-on individual?
Yeah, massively. I think when you look at some of the, you know, most influential people or teammates that I've played with, they're often the ones that don't need to say too much. You just know, you look in their eyes and you know that they're gonna do it. And all this stuff is great and is very important, but by far the best form of leadership that I've come across and that I've seen is through example, by your actions, by what you actually do. That tells your team and teammates way more than any speech, any, you know, nonverbal communication that you can do. That's always the best form of leadership is by playing well. You know, and everything else, you know, flows from that. And you need to, you know, you obviously want to improve on those things, but first and foremost, it's about playing well. If you play well, then you're doing at least 70-80% of leading effectively.
I also think that you're a brave leader as well. And I know one of the traits is strong convictions and the courage to stand apart. I don't think you can be a leader unless you stand apart. And I've seen, you know, over the last few years, you've had an opinion about social issues, political issues. You've spoken about Brexit and other things. How important is it for you to share those opinions and for people to understand what you stand for as a man, not just as a rugby player?
I think authenticity is a massive part of what I try to be anyway. I try and be as authentically myself as possible. Because that's what I respect in others. You know, I have teammates who hold, you know, wholly different views to me. But when they're principled and when they're authentic with that, I kind of respect it, as opposed to individuals who just sway with the wind.
Can you give us an example?
This is not my teammate, but an example being Novak Djokovic and his stance with regards to, I think it was the Australian Open and COVID, et cetera, et cetera. He made a stance of not believing it was the right thing for him to do individually. And whether that is right or wrong is a different conversation. But what I respect about that, he said, this is what I believe. These are my principles and I'm not bending. And normally what happens there is, you know, you get threatened with, you know, fines, you get threatened with playing opportunities, you get threatened with, you know, how you're seen socially. However, if you're truly principled, you're like, nah, that's against my values. And whether you agree or disagree is, for me, a different conversation. What I respect about that is that he believes something and he's willing to stand by it, come hell or high water. And I think there's something noble about that, whether or not you agree or disagree with what he's actually said.
And I appreciate you saying that, but because I know that in the back of your head is that little voice going, oh, do I even want to say this? Because the world we live in now, people will try and claim that I'm in agreement with what he... And I know what you mean. Like, I think we probably all disagreed with his stance, but I think we can all also understand that without disagreement, there's no progress.
Mm.
And it's a really important part, I think, of modern society that we're possibly losing the ability to do, which is to disagree but accept someone else's point of view.
Yeah, disagree agreeably.
People can't do it anymore.
I've read that, I might be wrong on this, I'd be interested if you confirm it, but at Saracens you've had things like book clubs or philosophy groups where you can have these debates around topics without having to seek that everyone achieves a consensus. Would you tell us about that and what sort of skills they've given you then?
Yeah, we haven't done it for a while, but we used to have this philosophy club as you've mentioned, and you know we'll explore a Greek philosophy or ancient Greek philosophy, whether it's Stoicism or whether it's, you know, Aristotle or something, or maybe it'll be in or around a virtue, like what is honesty, like what is being your genuine self type thing. And we'll just, you know, we'll more often than not start with a dialogue. Then we'll just discuss it and just see where it lands. And You know, for me, it's two parts. One, I find that kind of stuff interesting anyway. So it's always interesting to hear / learn more about it. And two, I guess it's good because it gives you a different insight into, you know, a different point of view and your teammate's point of view. And you mentioned like art, and it's a little bit similar to art in the sense that, you know, we can look at, you know, a painting, and your opinion of the painting could be totally different to mine. You know, but we're seeing the same thing. You know, we're seeing the exact same picture, but you could see that, oh, the trees mean this. Then I think, oh, they're just trees. They don't mean anything, type thing.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of thing. And I think it's always interesting to see a different point of view and, you know, test your point of view against theirs.
Should we do our quick fire questions? You've heard the podcast, so you know them, right?
I think so.
Let's see. The three non-negotiables that you and the people around you have to buy into.
I think with this, it's, you know, what I would like them to buy into. I don't always have full control of the people around me. But in terms of what, you know, I think are three things that is important that they have, especially if, you know, it wants to be a positive relationship with me, I would say honesty is a big one. Just being honest with me, being honest with yourself. If you think something is wrong, tell me. If you think something's good, you can also tell me as well. But let's get to the point as opposed to beat around the bush. And, you know, from there, we can build. And if something's wrong, we can fix that. I think respect is another one. Respect is just treating people with, you know, respect is massively important. You know, I think it's almost the foundations of any healthy relationship. And number three, I'll say punctuality. I think just being respectful of people's times. If you want to say you're going to be somewhere, be it. I don't really like being late for people. I don't really like it when people are late for, you know, meetings and stuff that I set up. So I would say punctuality is a big one there.
And by the way, this is now the Itoji question. I've rewritten it because you're right. You don't control people around you. So from now on, when you listen to this podcast, it will be, what are the three non-negotiables that you stand by and that you would like the people around you to buy into?
There we go. Yeah.
There you go.
What's your biggest weakness and your greatest strength, Mara?
Someone once told me that often the best thing about you can also be the worst. Mm. I think I'm very self-driven. I'm very independent, meaning that I don't often rely on other people for help.
Yeah.
I think my natural default is to be self-contained and, you know, manage everything myself, which I think is a big strength in a lot of areas. But I also think it can be a weakness in your professional life, but also outside of that, in your personal relationships as well, because you perhaps don't open yourself up to other people as much, or maybe you don't, showing vulnerability isn't the default.
Right. What's the hidden cost of living your life?
I think there are the few things. You know, you make a lot of sacrifices with regards to doing, you know, what we do with regards to time, and you miss a lot of momentous occasions. Like just last weekend, it was one of my best friend's birthdays, but I couldn't go to it because I had a game. You know, the amount of weddings, birthdays, christenings, family occasions, etc. that I've missed has been a lot. But, you know, that's a sacrifice that, you know, I would pay over and over again, because the flip side of that has allowed me to do so much. I think there's another aspect with regards to time as well. You know, playing rugby and, you know, playing at this level, it linked to what I said before, but it kind of brings a disjointedness to your life. You go into camps, you're here, then you're there, then you're there. And it's, I guess sometimes it's hard to keep up with friendships, hard to keep up with all these different types of aspects of your life. And with that, it's people's perceptions of you. Yeah, I meet someone on the street and they recognize me as a rugby player and they have a preconceived idea of me. And because they've obviously seen me play rugby, they think that, I think there's sometimes a barrier that they think that just because they're a fan or they're a supporter or they know who you are, they can either like one, speak to you in a certain way or one, you know, demand an aspect of your time or invade aspects of your privacy, etc. So I guess that's also a cost to it as well.
Very good. Listen, it's been a really fascinating hour and a bit. What would you like to leave our audience with? Your sort of final message for living a high-performance life, ringing in their ears. What would you like it to be?
Nothing too fancy from me. I would just say, you know, hard work is the foundation everything is built on. If you live a life of hard work and fulfillment, you know, you're probably more than likely to live a high performance life and you'll probably be happy doing it as well.
I love that. And in many ways, that answer sums up the whole interview, I think. You know, the words you say carry real weight and real resonance. And, you know, I think you can be understated, but an overachiever as well. And I think that is exactly what you are. You know, you don't feel the need to shout from the rooftops about what you've achieved. You talk about it with a real mental clarity. And it's highly impressive to spend an hour talking to you. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
The honor and the pleasure is all ours.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed that.
I enjoyed it
Thanks,
too.
Mara. Damien.
Jake.
Look, you spent a lot of time in and around the world of rugby. What did you make of Maro?
I thought he was fantastic. I thought he was that example that we spoke about being the captain class or what we call the cultural architects. I think he's a poster boy for that. I think he's cerebral. He thinks about his game. He's able to articulate it. He's a team player first. And I was really chuffed that we were able to explore some of those aspects with him.
Yeah. What stood out most?
I love the fact that he thinks about his craft. He thinks about the small things, you know, about the experience that he's described as a 16-year-old boy going up into the first team dressing room at Saracens and having John Smith and some of those big first name players come and shake his hand is something that he wants to pass on to the next generation himself. Having somebody that acknowledges that he might take his game right to the limits of what you'd consider sportsmanship, but understanding the reason he does it, is somebody that isn't just acting in an irrational or emotional way. He's a really considered, thoughtful character. And I think that really stood out for me, how smart he was.
Yeah. And I just love the fact that he describes himself as, you know, like a multifaceted individual. And you don't have to be as deep as Johnny Wilkinson to be there. You can be the way that Maro is, which is someone who isn't just, you know, we've said it before, he's not a rugby player, he's a guy who plays rugby and he came in, and for those that have listened to this rather than watched it on YouTube, he came in looking $1 million, massive smile on his face, talking about his interest in artwork and sort of discussing what he does away from rugby. And I do think we're seeing a change in the way that we view, talk about and consider our athletes. I mean, I'm still depressed by the negative reporting that I felt there was around the World Cup, you know, at the back end of 2022, and like one bad performance, it's the end of the world, one good performance, and it's the greatest thing we've ever seen. Everybody wants to have an opinion, everyone wants to be critical. I like to think that we're easing off on that a bit, maybe not fully, obviously, but hopefully, you know, the more we hear people like Maro talking the way that he did, the more it will change people's opinions, and we'll be reminded that actually these journalists are writing about humans, these football fans are tweeting about humans, you know, these are people and they're not perfect.
Yeah. Brilliant point. I think the final point I'd sort of highlight for that was just his definition of high performance and the distinction between high performance and elite performance. Like you said to him at the time, that's the first time we've had anybody draw us a distinction from that. And, you know, it's really made me reflect on like the standard of elite performance is one thing, but high performance is something that's subjective and relevant to all of us. And I'm really grateful that you shared that with us.
Me too. Thanks a lot, mate.
Thank you, mate. Loved it.
Okay, it's time for the part of the show that we love, where we get to speak to the people that actually listen and are impacted by the conversations we have here on the High Performance Podcast. And it's a real pleasure to welcome Arvin. Hey, Arvin.
Thank you, Jake. It's an absolute honor and a pleasure and a delight to be speaking to you. Honestly, like I think the work you guys are doing is just truly inspirational, and I'm grateful. So thank you. Yeah.
Oh man, you're very, very kind. So look, you sent us an email telling us all kinds of things about your life. Let's talk about the first thing. You run a small plant-based restaurant. Whereabouts is that? What's it called?
It's called Amrutha Lounge, and we're based in southwest London in Earlsfield. And it's a little restaurant, community-based restaurant, small restaurant, like 12 tables, but it's like coming to a friend's house for dinner.
So let's start with the restaurant then, Arvin. What's High Performance done for you as a businessman?
Oh, wow. Like, it's the thing with the High Performance is it's a the work you guys do, all of the guests you guys have on, what we try to preach at the restaurant and practice at the restaurant, it's all exactly the same thing. For me, there's one truth. There's literally one truth, and there's different interpretations of it, different levels to it, culture and people. It comes out in different ways, but essentially, it's all the same thing.
It sounds to me, Arvin, like there's some non-negotiable behaviours going on in your place. So tell us, what are the three non-negotiable behaviors that you and these angels that work for you have to buy into?
There's a couple of things we do. Very simply, we've got this little thing called pakoras, like deep fried vegetables. People go mad for it. It's just so simple, but people go mad for it. But every pakora leaves the kitchen perfectly golden and crispy, and every customer leaves with a smile on their face. If you do those two things, every single thing will work out completely. And I absolutely believe in that, and I absolutely practice that. And when we do that at the restaurant, it manifests itself. And what I mean by that, if you don't mind me expanding, okay, is when you pay that level of attention to each nugget of pakora coming out like a golden, perfect, crispy nugget, okay, then that level of care and attention you put into that one element of one menu will translate into other things. You're not going to have stodgy rice. You're not going to have hard rice. That same level of care will translate itself into other parts.
It sounds like a great example of the Sean Wayne episode where he told us that how you do anything is how you do everything. So the way you focus on this pakora is almost the way that it defines the whole culture of your brilliant restaurant.
Love it. The power of the pakora. Wonderful. Before we wrap this up, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story, you know, people may well listen to this and they will be like, well, yeah, that's great for Arvin. He's done really well. He's set up his restaurant. Life's easy for him. No wonder he feels great and High Performance feels simple. But as part of your message, you know, you told us that you've had some really, really dark times. Would you mind briefly touching on the thing you learned most in that time that you think would be really valuable for the people listening to this conversation, mate?
The thing is, like I say, like I've had wonderful people come into my life and guide me in ways where it just every day is just works out perfectly, and it's a process that's happening naturally. But at times, it only got there because there was a point when my mum, my best friend's mum, and another one of my best friend's mum, all within a very short period of time, all got diagnosed with different illnesses, and we all reacted in different ways. But that's when healthy eating and all of these things kind of came into my life, and something changed. And yoga, meditation, inspirational people, like the work you're doing, I promise you, I can't tell you the value of you. I'm sure you know the value of the work, but it's incredible because it allows people to connect. I don't want to get too dark with the stuff and things. I just want to keep it super positive because, like I say, everyone goes through stuff. I don't think the world admires people that have it all good and have it all be easy. I think the world admires people that have had a tough time, that have gone through things, but overcome those things.
I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing with us the things that you've learned from the podcast, Arvin. And listen, the next time that we're down in the capital, we want the works. I want to eat so much pakora, you roll me out of that restaurant, buddy.
Oh, a guaranteed. And thank you, boys, and continue the incredible work you're doing.
The pleasure's ours, Arvin. Thank you.
Well, that's it from this episode of the High Performance Podcast. Of course, thank you very much to Maro for joining us. Huge thanks to the whole High Performance team as well for their hard work creating this episode. But the biggest thanks goes to you. Listen, there's only one thing I ask you to do, and that is to share this content, whether you just want to ping it to a friend, WhatsApp it in a work WhatsApp group, stick it on your Instagram, tweet it. I don't mind, but you sharing this podcast is the single most important thing that you can do for us. Don't forget, you can also subscribe so that you get these podcasts sent straight to you. Anyway, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again soon for another episode of High Performance.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.